Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of July. I've been looking forward to this interview all week. It's a marvelous book, 1 Minute to Midnight by Michael Dobbs, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. Michael was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and educated at the University of York. He had fellowships at Princeton and Harvard. He's a reporter for the Washington Post and has spent much of his career as a foreign correspondent covering the collapse of communism. He's written other books, Down with Big Brother, The Fall of the Soviet Empire, and this book is a look at the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the question that he was most frequently asked was what new information could be left to reveal about a subject that has been studied by so many people. And he says that the answer, it turned out, was a great deal. The plot of the story, he writes in the preface, is simple enough. Two men, one in Washington, one in Moscow, struggle with the specter of nuclear destruction that they themselves had unleashed. But it is the subplots that give the story its drama. If seemingly minor characters sometimes threaten to take over the narrative, it's worth remembering that any one of these subplots could have become the main plot at any time. The issue was not whether Kennedy and Khrushchev wanted to control events. It was whether they could. And, of course, history shows that they did. But as he says, there's a lot to be learned from this particular history. The book is written, I think, for people who don't remember this time, because I keep forgetting that many people on Earth were not alive then. I was alive then. I was young, but I did follow it pretty carefully, but there are some people who don't know this story, so it's written, and those of you who are very young and don't know about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's certainly something you ought to know, and it's a terrific read. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you're joining us here, and if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Michael. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, I just love the read of the book. I didn't get through all of it. I don't have enough time, but I read good chunks of it until late last night. And I was amazed by many things, but it was amazing to me how many people were on totally different sides of this issue. Some who wanted to invade, some who were bullheaded. There were all these mistakes being made flying into Soviet airspace. I mean, it wasn't as though the two leaders of the world had total control over this situation, right?
Right, I think that's one of the great myths of the missile crisis. For 40 years, it's been taught as a prime example of what's called crisis management. But in fact, when you go into it in some detail, you see that the real risk of war did not come from the direct confrontation between Khrushchev and Kennedy, both of whom wanted to resolve this thing as best they could. It came from all the unpredictable incidents that happen as soon as you put the machinery of war into motion. And we saw that in Iraq, of course. We saw it in Bosnia before Serbia and Bosnia when we bombed the Chinese embassy by mistake. And there were all sorts of incidents like that that occurred during the 13 days of the missile crisis, any one of which could have led to a nuclear exchange between the two superpowers.
Yeah. Tell me about the personalities of the main figures who were handling this. That was an interesting part of the book as well. The relationship between Bobby Kennedy and John F. Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy kind of changed his mind as these 13 days went on. But he and John is kind of cool about this, but they're all realizing, as is Khrushchev actually, the enormous issue that they are dealing with. They're dealing with the possibility of a nuclear confrontation, for heaven's sake.
Right. I think, and what I set out to do was to describe the time, and particularly one day in particular, the what's known as Black Saturday, when the world came closest to nuclear destruction. And that really sobered up the principles, because both Jack Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev had experience of World War II. They had served in their militaries. They'd seen some of the terrible devastation of the Second World War, but they knew that this was going to be even worse in the event of a nuclear war. And Jack Kennedy sometimes asked his advisors, you know, what would happen if just one Soviet missile got through? and they said 600,000 casualties. They said we would win the war, but, you know, 600,000 casualties for just one missile getting through. And Kennedy said, well, you know, that's what the total casualties of the Civil War, and it's taken us a century to recover from that. So that was unacceptable to him. And although, you know, their initial instincts of both the Kennedy brothers was to attack Cuba with, first of all, with airstrikes and then with an invasion, they quickly thought better of it. And, you know, by the second week of the crisis, they're sort of frantically trying to resolve it, but it's very difficult to communicate with the other side.
Right. Very difficult. We didn't have computers with instant messaging or any of that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And in fact, it took 12 hours in those days to send a message
from
Washington to Moscow. There was no such thing as the hotline. The famous hotline was introduced as a result of the missile crisis, partly because of the communications difficulties they had during the crisis.
And tell us part of the reason that airstrikes and invasions seemed something that the Kennedys had to consider, partially because they were thought of as, you know, not very strong on defense. There were midterm elections coming up. The
right.
Bay of Pigs was part of all of this. They needed to kind of flex their muscle, right?
Yeah, you have to put this in the political context of October 1962, 1 month before the midterm elections. The Kennedys were coming under severe criticism from the Republicans, who were saying they weren't doing enough. The president wasn't doing enough to get rid of Castro, to stop the threat from Castro's Cuba. Castro had been in power in Cuba for about 2 years. And we knew that a lot of the Soviet Union was shipping a lot of weaponry across the ocean, but it wasn't clear whether this was defensive weapons for the defense of Cuba against an American invasion or offensive weapons. And they sent a U-2 spy plane over eventually and discovered that there were missiles there that could target half the United States.
Can you imagine what a discovery that was? You walk into work and you find out that you got all these missiles that could take on the U.S.?
Right. I mean, actually, that's an interesting story because they figured out on October the 15th, the CIA did, that the Soviets had missiles in Cuba and late on the night of October 15th. And Mac Bundy, who's the national security advisor, decided not to waken Kennedy that night. And we've heard about this famous 3 a.m. phone call. But Bundy decided it was better to give the president a good night's sleep because he knew that he was going to need his wits about him for the next couple of weeks. And the great advantage that Kennedy had, at least during the first phase of the crisis, was that it wasn't public, that the administration knew that the Soviets had these nuclear missiles in Cuba, but the public didn't know. So they had a week to decide how they were going to respond. And they were determined to get the missiles out of Cuba, but there was a debate going on about how they were going to do that. Would they do it by bombing the missile sites, by an invasion, or what they eventually decided was a naval blockade or quarantine?
Mm-hmm. And then you had all these side thing happen, any one of which could have made somebody push a button here. Tell us the story. It's a very interesting story of, you know, the pilot, Charles Maltby, who went into the Soviet Union after taking off. He gets caught up in aurora borealis. He can't figure out where he's going. He's having this tremendously difficult flight and winds up over Soviet airspace
right.
during this very time.
That's extraordinary, not only during the 2 weeks, the 13 days, but during the most critical day of all, Black Saturday. I mean, just to set the context here, both sides were testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, and we used to send U-2 reconnaissance planes to the North Pole to pick up nuclear radioactive debris from the Soviet tests to analyze them. And these missions had been going on all the time, and they continued throughout the missile crisis without anybody really being aware of it. Certainly the president wasn't aware of it, and nor was the defense secretary, Bob McNamara. And so this pilot, Captain Maltby, goes off on what's meant to be a routine mission to the North Pole to collect some radioactive samples and come back to Alaska. and he gets blinded by the Aurora Borealis, his navigation systems. You know, there's no GPS in those days, don't work. And he takes a wrong turn and blunders over the Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the Cold War.
Goodness.
The next day, Khrushchev writes to Kennedy and said, you know, we could have mistaken this plane for a nuclear bomber, and it could have, you know, caused us to retaliate. You know, fortunately we didn't, but it could have had very, very serious consequences.
Exactly. And then you also have the U-2 plane being shot down over Cuba, which could have had serious consequences.
Actually, at just about at the identical time,
one
plane was being lost over the Soviet Union, another U-2 plane was lost over Cuba. It was shot down by the Russians. And I think I've pieced together why the Russians shot it down. It had overflown a forward position of a Soviet cruise missile unit near the Guantanamo naval base. The Soviets were planning to, as the first step, had the U.S. invaded Cuba, the first thing the Soviets would have done would have been to use tactical nuclear weapons to wipe out the Guantanamo naval base. And those advanced positions were discovered by that U-2 plane, which is why the Soviet commanders on Cuba, without authorization from Moscow, because there wasn't time to receive it, decided to shoot down the U-2, the other U-2, piloted by a man called Major Anderson, who was the only combat casualty of the missile crisis.
Hmm. And then you've got this, tell us the story, because what Wisconsin's involved in this, I won't give the end of what happened, but you get somebody tripping off an alert. And all these nuclear warheads ready to go because this alarm goes off in Duluth, was it?
In Wisconsin, yeah. I mean, in here's your local angle. Now I have to get this right, but just to set the scene there, as soon as the missile crisis started, the U.S. was fearful that our nuclear bombers would be wiped out by Soviet strikes. So they had to disperse the nuclear bombers all over the country. And they sent them, some of them were sent to civilian airports, and some were sent to various unused military fields in Wisconsin and other places. And one of the bombers flew into these little used fields. And at one point during the second week of the crisis, there was a bear triggered an alarm, for a few minutes the first thing, of course, they had to do was to when that kind of alarm went off was to launch all the planes at the airfield, and so the planes were about to launch, were on the runway. This is about 2 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, gee.
There was a thick snowstorm. The planes were about to launch, and at the last moment, they realize that it's a mistake, and they send the only way of communicating with the pilot is to send a jeep onto the field and physically stop the planes from launching. But, you know, that's another kind of example of how everything was at hair trigger during that period.
Right. They were about a minute away, your book says, from launching.
Right. I spoke to to one of the pilots who was on the runway ready to launch.
Wow. Who did you spoke to a lot of people for this book. You spoke to some Russians, right, who were involved in all of this, who really hadn't been talked to before.
Right. I think that's one of the new things about the book. I had been the Washington Post correspondent in Moscow during the collapse of communism. So I have a sort of long interest in Russia and speak Russian. So one of the things I was able to do was to track down Soviet officers who were on Cuba in October 1962, the people who actually handled the warheads and handled the missiles, and were responsible for targeting them on the United States. And they're now, of course, mostly in the 70s, 80s, but they have, you know, incredible stories to tell. And so I was able to use a lot of their information and then try to confirm it through declassified U.S. intelligence sources.
Mm-hmm. And I love your descriptions of the way they set foot on the island. The Cubans thought they were rather boorish, right? A lot of drinking, a lot of...
Right. Well, Cuba had just freed itself from American domination. Then they had the Russians moving in. And the Russians, you know, the Russians were friendly, but they were, as you say, boorish, and they liked to drink a lot. I mean, they also lived in, you know, complete poverty. So the Cubans, you know, started asking themselves questions about, you know, they had exchanged one form of domination for another form, and they weren't quite sure whether this one was better than the people they just got rid of.
Mm-hmm. And Castro was kind of a wild guy during all of this, wasn't he? He was ready to just go ahead and bomb the U.S.
I think, you know, of the three principals, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro, Castro was the only one who was really willing and prepared to fight a nuclear war, even on his own territory. He was prepared to authorize the use of Soviet tactical nuclear weapons to defeat an American invading force and to wipe out the Guantanamo naval base. And, of course, he was the weakest of the three, so therefore he had to demonstrate complete defiance of the United States in order to survive, and that's his basic modus operandi. But so it's difficult to tell, you know, where his bluster ends and where, you know, political calculation begins. But I think he was certainly prepared to die, and so were his closest comrades, and they were willing to take a lot of their fellow countrymen with them.
Mm. Let's welcome phone calls. I don't mean to hog the conversation. I just find it a fascinating time in history. The book is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. Michael Dobbs is the author of the book. He's a reporter for the Washington Post, spent a lot of his career as a foreign correspondent covering the collapse of communism, spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union, and speaks Russian, as you heard him say. There's a lot of new information in this book concerning the Soviet plan to destroy, as he just said, Guantanamo naval base, a fascinating chapter on the overflight of the Soviet Union by the U-2 pilot Charles Maltsby, and look more at the U.S. naval blockade, the handling of Soviet nuclear weapons on Cuba, etc. Some of you lived through that time. What did you know at that time? Do you feel that you were informed about this? And some of you may be hearing, no fault to history teachers, there's just so much to teach, but there are some Americans now who are not aware of how close we came on that day to a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. It was a scary time. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Michael Dobbs. His book is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War, just been published by Knopf. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Ron from La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I remember that Cuban Missile Crisis. I was 11 years old at the time. I was attending a Catholic parochial school. And I do remember, and I would read the newspapers once in a while, and just prior before this thing started to blow up in October of 62, I do remember seeing some small articles that, you know, they were suspecting the Russians were putting missiles in Cuba, but they were just small articles. You know, there wasn't much attention to it at the time. And then one day in October, I was in the fifth grade, and over the school PA system, they had Pike Kennedy's address about, you know, these, clandestine action and all that. But I don't remember being particularly scared about it, and I think it had something to do with the fact that we were way up in Wisconsin, and we felt that, you know, we weren't within range of these missiles. They didn't have that great a range, I guess, to touch us. Of course, that would be folly not to worry about because of the fallout. But I was not spooked so much about during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was over a year before during an April 1961 bomb test that the Russians did, and they detonated this huge hydrogen bomb, and we were told in April of 61 after that explosion that the Russians did that we were should stay indoors because they were worried that the rain that we were getting that April might bring down radioactive fallout. You know, I had seen a year or so before that movie On the Beach, and that really left me scared.
Right, you're referring to the, I think the Russians called it the Tsar bomb, which was the largest nuclear explosion ever before or since in the atmosphere. And the Soviets tested that, as you say, in 1961. But one of the extraordinary things was that I wasn't aware of until I researched this book was that tests in the atmosphere were continuing through October 1962. So at the very same time that the two sides were threatening each other with nuclear weapons, they were actually exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere. And during the 13 days, there were about four or five nuclear tests. We were conducting it in the South Pacific, and the Soviets were conducting them in a place called Novaya Zemlya on the northern coast of Russia, which is why the U.S. sent planes to the North Pole to monitor those tests.
Unlike Ron, who was in Wisconsin and thought he was safe, I was really struck by how the Kennedys and various people in government did on some very deep level think this may be it, that they made plans to move government out of Washington and whether or not they were going to take their families and whether or not they were going to live to see another day.
Right. I mean, curiously, the higher you were, the more alarmed you were, probably because you had more information. And there were plans to evacuate the White House during the critical week of the crisis. And there was a shadow government had been set up at a place called Mount Weather, about half an hour's helicopter flight from Washington in West Virginia. Still the same, I think the same bases are used today. So, and several times during the crisis, you have one of Kennedy's aides turning to another and saying, you know, I hope we see you tomorrow. They didn't know if they were going to go back home and would see their families again or what was going to happen.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Let's go to Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. In 1962, I just started counting normal. And I just got a halfway decent memory of just how scary that situation was. I remember when they were moving troops to the southeast of Florida, and we didn't know what was going to happen. Well, it was going to be an invasion, and the county normals only had about 60 students there, but we were all talking about it until the situation calmed down. And thank goodness for Kennedy. And his advisors wanted him, like you said earlier, I remember his advisors wanted him to go, and he said, no, let's stop and take a second look at this. We came so close. That's got to be the most scariest time period in American history.
Well, you're right about the invasion preparations and the sort of huge deployment of men and materiel to South Florida, which sort of was very similar, actually, to the buildup in England prior to the D-Day Normandy landings. Had the U.S. invaded Cuba, it would have been very similar to the D-Day landings in Normandy, about a similar force across a similar front. The difference would have been, is that unknown to the Kennedy administration at the time, the Soviets had not only these long-range nuclear missiles for use against the United States, they had short-range tactical nuclear missiles, which would have been used to wipe out American beachheads. So an American invading force, and I've spoken to some of the people who would have taken part in it, would have, you know, faced such devastating consequences had they attempted to land in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. And does it in some ways come down to people and who leaders are? I know that there are all these other unforeseen circumstances, but I was struck by the last words in your afterword that the story is replete with misunderstandings and miscalculations, but something more than dumb luck was involved in sidestepping a nuclear apocalypse. The real good fortune is that men as sane and level-headed as Kennedy and Khrushchev occupied the White House and the Kremlin in October of 62.
I think one of the things this episode illustrates is the importance of personality in politics, and particularly at this level. I'm not uncritical by any means of Kennedy and Khrushchev.
Right.
I think they helped get us into this mess. Khrushchev through recklessly sending nuclear missiles to Cuba, and Kennedy through a sort of series of provocative steps in Cuba, including secret war against Castro, sabotage attempts, which caused Khrushchev to look for ways to defend his ally in Cuba. But, having said that they, helped get us into this mess, both of them showed great responsibility during the 13 days. And I think they ended up being on pretty much the same side, although they didn't know it. They were both facing, calls from their respective hardliners for to take a much tougher stand, and they resisted them. And they both realized that the consequences of a nuclear war would be disastrous. And so they were both looking for a way out of the crisis. The question was whether they could find the way out before some, unpredictable incident took place that, caused some kind of, that caused the firing to start. And it would have been very difficult to control once it had started.
Right. Eugene, thanks for your call. Jim is next from Salem. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just kind of a personal aside. My dad was a CB in the Navy. They're their construction battalions. And he was in Cuba building the defensive perimeter around Guantanamo Bay just prior to and during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Excuse me. And sometime early in the morning of the announcement, about 2 a.m. in the morning that Kennedy announced the embargo, his unit was, now these are, construction guys, his unit was issued their weapons, drew ammunition, and occupied bunkers that overlooked the no man's land strip between Cuba and, Guantanamo Bay.
Right, they obviously went to battle readiness as soon as the missile crisis became public. And there were, Guantanamo at that point was a kind of American suburb in the middle of Cuba. It looked like a typical American suburb, and there were families, schools, people riding their bicycles. All the women and children were evacuated, and they reinforced the base with several thousand Marines. They were quite prepared for an attack from the Cuban side.
Hmm.
But they weren't prepared for a nuclear attack, which is what might have happened.
Mm-hmm.
They were anticipating. And, in fact, they occupied their defensive positions. And then just before dawn, apparently there was a little strip of no man's land between Cuba and the Guantanamo Bay installation that was farmed by a Cuban farmer. And sometime before dawn, my father witnessed the Cuban farmer signaling with a flashlight out his window toward the Cuban lines and radioed it in, and they sent a detachment of Marines down there to see what was going on. And apparently, he was signaling them. The Marines showed up, rousted him out of the house, took the Cuban family, as I apparently had a couple of kids, a wife and a couple of kids, pushed them toward the Cuban side of the gate and burned the farm down. And to my knowledge, that little strip of no man's land has been ever since completely unoccupied.
That's interesting. During the missile crisis, actually, there was still quite a bit of back and forth between Cubans coming onto the base and servicing the base. Several thousand Cubans came onto the base every day, including, of course, they were infiltrated by Castro's spies. Some of them were loyal to the United States, others were loyal to Cuba, but it was not, as it is now, a complete iron curtain between the naval base and the rest of the island. There was a lot of people going back and forth during the up until the missile crisis and during the missile crisis.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Phil next from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi, I think you've got an interesting book. I think I know what I'm doing Saturday now. I've read quite a bit about the Russian Navy after the loss to the Kursk and then Howard Hughes' attempt with the Glomar Challenger and Explorer to raise the ship off of Hawaii. And in those books, as a sidelight, they mentioned that they had talked to Russian officers who were on ships, submarines, at the Cuban Missile Crisis, that they had infiltrated the line, the embargo line, and those ships were equipped with nuclear-tipped torpedoes. And at that point in the Russian Navy, the command to launch those torpedoes were at the discretion of the officer, the command officer on the ship. Is that true?
Actually, the missile-carrying ships turned around. I showed that Khrushchev did turn his missile-carrying ships around as soon as Kennedy went on TV. So there wasn't this eyeball-to-eyeball moment on the blockade line that we've been led to believe. On the other hand, you're right that there were submarines, in the Soviet submarines, in the vicinity of the blockade line, and they were armed with nuclear torpedoes. I don't think that the captains had authorization to use those nuclear torpedoes, but the conditions on board the ships were, terrible. That they weren't equipped for traveling as far as they did. It was 110, 120 degrees. The U.S. Navy started, in order to force the submarines to the surface, they started sending down depth charges. The skippers of the submarines didn't know what was happening. They thought that, a war might have been going on above their heads. They didn't have communications with Moscow. So even though they, I don't think, had authorization from Moscow to use their nuclear torpedoes, it's quite possible there could have been unauthorized use of nuclear weapons had they thought that war had already begun and they'd lost communications with Moscow. I think the more dangerous thing was unauthorized use rather than authorized use.
That's very interesting because I think that's a whole other nuclear dimension in this that I have to believe I've never heard mentioned before, and this was just a sidelight in a book about submariners.
Right, I go into quite a lot of detail about the conditions on board those Soviet nuclear submarines and the tension and stress felt by the Soviet submariners. And certainly that's another incident that could have had alarming consequences. At one point, one of the submarines, they put the nuclear torpedo into the chamber, and so essentially it came down to the decision of the skipper whether or not to use the torpedo to defend himself. Of course, he had no means of communicating with Moscow. All he knew was that there were American warships above trying to get him to surface.
Right. Oh, gives you the chills to think about the what ifs. Tell me about the use of media. You mentioned Kennedy going on television. At what point during this crisis did he use television? And then also tell it's jumping ahead, but the end when Nikita Khrushchev has this radio announcer from Russia who's announcing what the Soviets are going to do. How was the press used in both countries?
Well, of course, the press is very different. In the Soviet Union, it was completely under the control of the government. But here, actually, Kennedy was a great spin master of the press. He personally called editors and reporters and gave them the line. And by and large, the press followed the line from the White House. And they didn't publicize. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but the president and his advisors had a week to consider their options before word leaked to the press. And it was only, with the president's televised broadcast that the country knew that there was a risk of war with the Soviet Union. So I think there was quite a bit of, you know, press management on Kennedy's part. As for the Russians, at the end, as I said, that it took, you know, 12 hours to send messages back and forth, and by the final day, Khrushchev was so alarmed he thought he didn't have 12 hours to signal that he was going to withdraw his missiles from Cuba. So they decided, instead of sending a ciphered telegram to Washington, that they would make the announcement on Moscow radio. So they, after the presidium, the Soviet leadership decided to withdraw the missiles, they sent a courier to Moscow radio, and they had to make it by 5 o'clock because they thought that Moscow time, they thought that the Americans might attack Cuba before 5 o'clock. It was a rush to get the announcement on the air, and the courier reached the radio station just before the deadline, and the speakers went on the air immediately and made the announcement live, which was unusual for, in Soviet practice at that time.
Because they used to rehearse everything over and over,
right?
They liked
to rehearse everything, exactly.
Yeah, and Castro didn't have the news.
Well, because they were in such a rush to announce it on the radio, they had no time to get in touch with Castro and tell him what was happening. So he heard it on the radio as well. And in fact, the Soviet ambassador was asleep at the time, and it was Cuban time, about 8 o'clock in the morning, Cuban time. And the senior Cuban official called him at home and said, "The Russians are withdrawing the missiles. You know, what's happening?" And he said, "Don't believe imperialist propaganda." And they said, "It's not imperialist propaganda. It's Radio Moscow." And Castro was absolutely furious with the Russians for withdrawing their missiles.
Yeah. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return and welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Michael Dobbs is our guest. His book is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. And if you want to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to an email, Michael. I just wanted to tell you that I was there in the military intelligence service, and a hair trigger was always the only option since the island was only 90 seconds by fighter jet from the continental United States. Knowing what was happening was extremely difficult to manage. Luckily, nothing untoward happened and we survived. I wish I could tell you more, but I'm still under a gag order by the government since I had a code word clearance and knew what was happening.
I think it was a little more than 90 seconds by fighter jet. It was probably about 10 minutes. I mean, it's 80 miles from Key West. I don't have any fighter jet that can cover that distance in 90 seconds, but perhaps that was a typo or something.
Yeah. Could a person still be under a gag order by the government because they had a code word clearance at this point in time?
Yeah, I mean, there are some aspects of the missile crisis that are still secret. I was surprised by the... You know, it's now 45 years gone by, and the CIA has published a lot, but there's still some aspects that are secret. For example, Chuck Maltsby's flight is still secret, partly because I think that the National Security Agency, which monitors, which monitored Soviet air defenses, helped figure out where Maltsby was and bring him back. I think I've reconstructed that incident pretty exhaustively, but without any help from the Air Force, who hadn't released a single document about what happened to Maltsby and how he got lost and how he was recovered.
So where did you get all the info?
I got it from, he died of cancer a few years back, but I got it from his widow, from a memoir that he left. And I also found odd documents in the archives showing precisely where he'd gone over the Soviet Union. I found a map of his flight path. And I found some messages in the Kennedy library, which allowed me to piece together exactly his route and when he was exactly where. But the Air Force has not released a single document about it.
Hmm. Let's go to Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hello. On government secrets, yeah, the standard is usually 50 years, but there are some secrets that you can't reveal for 75. But I remember a convoy of Russian ships coming towards Cuba, and the radios would interrupt the rock and roll programs, giving how far they were from the American blockade. And I remember my girlfriend and I looking towards Milwaukee and Chicago at night to see how they were going to be wiped off the map.
As I said, some of that is myth. I mean, although the Kennedys did believe that the Soviet ships were challenging the blockade, I showed that Khrushchev decided to turn his missile-carrying ships around. He did allow the submarines to continue. But there's the famous quote from Secretary of State Dean Rusk: "We were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked."
Right.
And I think that Khrushchev had blinked the first day and had turned his ships around a day before that supposed eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation. And this all leads me to think that the real risk of war came not from the conscious decisions of Kennedy and Khrushchev, because both of them were trying mightily to avoid the worst, but it came from the unpredictable incidents. And like, you know, when Kennedy heard that Captain Maltsby had gone missing over the Soviet Union, he said, "There's always some son of a bitch that doesn't get the word." And I think one of the lessons of this episode is that the son of a bitch moments, the people who don't get the word, are a bigger danger in this case and perhaps in other cases than the decisions of the political leaders.
Yeah, that's what I felt reading it, that's for sure. Well, I don't think we've talked very much about Turkey. What was the deal that was thrown in about Turkey?
Well, the United States had intermediate-range weapons and missiles in Turkey across the Black Sea from Khrushchev's dacha or summer residence. And Khrushchev was seething that the United States would deploy missiles just on the periphery of the Soviet Union, and he couldn't do the same in Cuba. And I think that was one of his motivations for giving Uncle Sam a taste of its own medicine. On the final day of the crisis, Kennedy has decided that he's not going to go to war over a few obsolete missiles in Turkey. So he sends his brother, Bobby, to the Soviet embassy in Washington to tell send a message to Khrushchev saying that he is prepared to dismantle these Jupiter missiles in Turkey, but the deal cannot be public. He promises Khrushchev that within 2 or 3 months, the missiles will all be gone, but on condition that Khrushchev keeps this secret. And that was, in fact, kept secret.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Tim from Milwaukee. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for another great show, Kathleen. Other people have talked about what they were doing during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I figured out about 10 years ago that I was conceived during the Missile Crisis. And so I've done a lot of unsystematic reading about it since then, and always thought it was a great act of faith on my parents to bring in number 6 into the world during that time.
Right.
Some people thought, I spoke to somebody who got on a plane. He was a professor in Boston, and he was so alarmed by was happening that he got on the first plane to Australia.
And left his family and
left
his students.
Behind.
I know.
And, he was actually separated from his wife at the time, but he left his job and his family and ends up in Sydney in the middle of the missile crisis. He later feels a little sheepish and comes back.
I can see why.
People reacted in different ways. Parents certainly reacted in a different way.
I'm wondering if your guests would be willing to go back to Bobby Kennedy's role. I'm also interested because Bobby Kennedy's assassination is my first political memory when I was 5, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little more about that. As Attorney General, I didn't assume he had direct lines of communication, but what his advice was or anything else you can offer about Bobby.
Well, his attorney general role, I think, masks his true position, which was deputy president, virtually, and the closest advisor to his brother. He's a very complex, emotional character. And at the beginning, he certainly favored an attack on the missile sites. He was very upset with the Russians for putting in the missiles there. He regarded that as a personal affront, betrayal by Kent, by Khrushchev. And he urges his brother to as he puts it, organize some kind of sink the Maine type incident. The Maine was a battleship that was sunk in Havana Harbor during the Spanish-American War, and the Americans blamed it on the Spaniards. So Bobby Kennedy also ran the secret war against Castro, which was known as Operation Mongoose. So he wanted to get even with Kennedy, with Khrushchev and Castro. But then later, in the middle of the crisis, he kind of does a 180-degree turn and becomes very alarmed about the way things are going, and is one of the people who are advising his brother to do whatever he can to get out of the crisis. So, he like some other people, changed from the first day to the end.
And thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Karen next from Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'll make this quick if I can. My husband and I were college students at the time in Minnesota. And this was, well, of course, when no college students had TVs in their rooms. There were probably about 7 televisions on the campus. And I remember coming out, I was a senior, and I remember coming out from the cafeteria to where one of the televisions was in a small alcove. There must have been 200, 300 students gathered around the TV watching the announcement about this. And most of the young men who were there figured, oh, we'll be drafted very soon now. And my husband reports that some of his friends even said, well, it doesn't pay to study for any more tests. And there is something to be said for the draft in that it makes many, many more people engaged in what's going on. 4 years later, my husband was drafted because of the Vietnam War and ended up a munitions officer in the Air Force with top secret nuclear clearance because he was working with loading of nuclear weapons on airplanes. And I think so much back, we've talked about that time so many times over our lives together, and realize that now there are so many people who don't care about young men and women who are dying in Iraq and Afghanistan, and because they don't feel the personal danger, which we all felt at that time, because anyone in your family could end up serving in the military. Thank you so much for writing this book to the guest, and thank you very much, Kathleen, for this program. I'll just listen off.
All right, Karen. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Well, reservists were called up during the missile crisis. They didn't actually draft anybody because it only lasted for 13 days, but they probably would have done. There would have been more people called up. They needed nearly 500,000 people, half a million servicemen to invade the island. And, of course, had it gone to a nuclear war, then virtually the entire country would have been mobilized.
Yeah. Let's go to Paul from Madison, running a little short on time, everybody. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was in Great Falls, Montana during the crisis, and we had food and water in our basements, and I requested permission to fill in our window wells to seal off the basements. And the base commander, who was in his underground bunker, said, no, we shouldn't do it because we didn't want to deface the appearance of the base.
Huh.
So at that time, I was wondering if the crisis was real, but after reading this book, I was obviously wrong. It was real.
Hmm.
It was. I mean, I think this is the closest we came to nuclear war, and either before or since, and the prospect of a nuclear exchange, really made a big impression on anybody who lived through it, particularly the principals, particularly the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it rather a profound thought that it turned out the way it did? Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking about it, right? Who knows what would be here?
Well, this is one of the things that Jack Kennedy said about the people who were advising him to attack Cuba. He said that, the brass, as he called them, they have one great advantage, because if I follow their advice, we won't be nobody will be around to know that they were wrong.
right.
And so he felt a sense of responsibility, not only to the country, but I think also to the entire world and young people in many different he used to talk about children who in other countries who he said, didn't bear any responsibility for the crisis, but whose lives would be mm-hmm. affected and perhaps even snuffed out
right.
If things went wrong.
We all breathe the same air. Well, it's a terrific book. It's so well written, too. I thank you very much for writing it, Michael.
Well, it was very interesting to write, and I'm glad I found a few new things, and I hope that I'll introduce a new generation of people who didn't experience it directly and will, realize what we went through at that time and mm-hmm. Draw some topical lessons.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's what you've done. Michael Dobbs, the book is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. It has just been published by Knopf. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, to John Anderson for on-air production, and thanks for your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.